This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Lynn Neary in Washington, sitting in for Neil Conan. Yesterday, the last soldier left. 3 weeks ago, the last settlers left. For the first time in 38 years, Israel is out of Gaza. Israel still controls its borders and checkpoints, as well as water and electricity, but Palestinians are now closer to holding their fate in their own hands. The world will be watching closely in coming weeks and months to see how the Palestinians deal with this new freedom and with whatever assets the Israelis left behind. Can they quell the violence, overcome corruption, and rebuild an economy that has literally been reduced to rubble? We'll go to Israel for the latest news, talk with a settler who left, and analyze what the future may hold for Gaza and Israel. Do you have questions about the new relationship between Palestinians and Israelis? How has it changed? How is it the same? Join the conversation. Our number here in Washington is 800-989-8255. That's 800-989-TALK. And our email address is totn@npr.org. Later in the program, we'll review highlights from today's Senate confirmation hearings for Chief Justice of the United States. But first, life after the Gaza pullout. Joining us now is Carol Hezzi, a settler who used to live in the Gadid settlement in Gaza. She joins us by phone from her hotel near Jerusalem. Hi, thanks for being with us, Carol.
You're welcome.
Now, I know you talked with the program a few weeks ago. Soon after leaving Gaza, you are still living in a hotel. Are you any closer to getting permanent housing at this point?
It's being built. They're starting to build it, put it that way. Nothing's on the ground yet, but the papers have been signed.
Now, I know that you and your neighbors from Gadid were hoping to stay together as something of a community. Is that what you're still working on? Are you going to be able to do that?
Yes, that's the plan.
Maybe you could explain what it is you're planning to do. What is it you're building?
The government is building temporary housing, temporary meaning for 2 or 3 years. They're sort of like prefabricated, or what they call caravans. They're like mobile homes, but they're not on wheels.
Right. And you'll be in some kind of a community with the people that you live nearby in the settlement.
And we'll be about half of the people who were living in Gadid.
Yeah. Have your feelings at all changed in these few weeks about disengagement? Or what are your feelings now?
Nothing. No, nothing's changed. We had to sit yesterday and watch or choose not to watch the Palestinians looting and burning and destroying the synagogues that were left.
Did you watch?
No, I refused to watch.
Did other people around you watch? Was your husband watching? Or
no. Most everybody I knew either wouldn't turn on the television at all or turned it right off. It's too hard to watch that.
Yeah. What are conditions like where you're living now?
As far as hotel goes, it's quite nice, but it's hard to live in a hotel for more than a few days.
Yeah, and what do you envision for the future? What this place you're going to be in mobile homes? That's temporary housing. I mean, what do you see the future for yourself at this point? Really,
it's not something particularly to look forward to. A mobile home is much smaller than, of course, the houses that we had. And not as weatherproof. It's not really something to look forward to, but it's going to have to suffice for 2 or 3 years until the ground can be prepared for building something more permanent.
And I understand you'd want to be in a religious community. Is that right? And if so, why is that?
Because that's what we were used to.
Uh-huh. Why is that important?
We built up a community. Mm-hmm. We built up a community in the sense of people, like almost family. So you don't want to go and just, start your life over among a bunch of strangers.
Right. How about your children? What's happening for your children right now?
My children have gone... The two who are in high school have gone back to studying. actually have gone back to school. I don't know how much studying they're doing. I think it's hard for them to concentrate.
Mm-hmm.
And the people here who have the smaller children, they've opened temporary schools here in the hotel.
Yeah. What is your attitude towards the Israeli government at this point, you and the other people from your community?
I think people are still feel betrayed by the government, really, because we went to make our home in a place that the government encouraged us to go to, and then it's sort of changed its mind and started treating us as if we'd caused all the problems in the whole country.
Do you feel that the pullout is in any way going to lead to a greater possibility for peace in the region?
We don't really think so. If there was going to be a peace, then why were the synagogues destroyed by the Arabs? I mean, we've got mosques standing in Israel that no one would dare destroy. And the whole, even the government, as soon as they said that the graves that were in Gush Katif had to be moved, it meant that they didn't believe that there would be any peace, because otherwise why not leave a cemetery? I mean, there's Jewish cemeteries in Europe, in all sorts of places, and where the Jews don't actually live anymore, where the people who, the families of the buried ones don't live. Maybe there's some Jews there. But as soon as the government talked about this one unilateral pullout, they started talking about moving the cemetery, which means that they didn't really even believe that there would be peace.
Do you think you'll ever get over this, or do you think you'll always feel a certain amount of bitterness about this decision?
I think we'll probably always feel badly about this decision. I mean, we'll probably go on with our we'll go on with our lives. We'll rebuild personally, but I think it's a sore effect for the whole country. Actually, it's like something has been cut off, some part of the, you know, the tip of your finger or something. So you do go on, but it's not the same.
All right. Well, thanks so much for being with us, Carol.
You're welcome.
Carol Hezzi is a former resident of the Gadid settlement in Gaza. She joined us by phone from her hotel near Jerusalem. Early yesterday morning, as the last of Israel's soldiers withdrew from the Gaza Strip, Palestinians embraced their new freedom with cheers, flag waving, and gunshots. It is now the day after, and many Palestinians are facing the reality of trying to build a nation with what's left behind. For a better picture of the situation in Gaza, we turn to Scott Wilson, the Jerusalem bureau chief for the Washington Post, who joins us by phone from his home in Jerusalem. Thanks for being with us, Scott.
Thank you.
Maybe you could describe what it was like, first of all, in Gaza yesterday when the last Israeli troops left.
Yeah, it was quite a scene. I visited about a half dozen of the former settlement areas, starting in Netzarim, which is up near the north and near Gaza City. And it was just tens of thousands of Palestinians had been coming in since just after dawn and picking through these giant piles of rubble that were once homes just as recently as 3 weeks ago, and scaling the former synagogue buildings and planting partisan banners on top of them, of Hamas, of Islamic Jihad, of the ruling Fatah movement. Walking out of these places on roads that they've never even been allowed to walk along. They've never been allowed to get remotely close to some of these places and have been just consumed by curiosity for years and years. I talked to people who used to play soccer on some of the land that had become a settlement, people pulling out rose bushes to replant in their gardens to remember this day. They were looking for souvenirs and things to sell in flea markets, everything from streetlights to electrical cord being torn out of walls. And so it was just sort of a giant mixture of a giant scavenger hunt as well as a sort of venue for celebration in the number of these places. And a lot of happiness, but also some unease from Palestinians who didn't like to see, I think, a lot of their fellow citizens, you know, sort of picking through rubble left by Israel.
Yeah.
It's not a great message to be sending out, and sort of, I think, hindered some of the celebration for some of the Palestinians in there.
We are talking about the Israeli pullout from Gaza and the future of Gaza. If you'd like to join our discussion, if you have any questions about the new relationship between Israel and the Palestinians, give us a call at 1-800-989-8255. That's 1-800-989-TALK. What about the burning of the synagogues? Tell us something about that, Scott.
There was sort of a tacit agreement, as your previous guest pointed out. This was a unilateral Israeli withdrawal from Gaza after 38 years. The Gaza was taken in the 1967 Middle East War by Israel in fighting against Egypt and Syria and Jordan, and it had remained there and built these settlements both for defensive reasons and also to settle land that was considered part of Greater Israel. They were going to leave. Basically, the agreement was that Israel would destroy all of the buildings that were not going to be of any use to the Palestinian Authority, did that to a large degree. They left behind 4,000 greenhouses that were purchased by a private foundation, are going to be passed over to the Palestinians. That's really the most valuable asset that Israel left behind, the real backbone of the agricultural economy there. And destroyed all of the homes, but largely to prevent inter-Palestinian fighting over who gets to live in them, and those sorts of things. I mean, if there was some scuffling over mounds of rubble yesterday, you can only imagine what it might have been like if there were actually homes standing there in a very densely populated and poor coastal strip, how much demand there would have been for those. Suddenly, at the last minute, though, the government voted to keep the former synagogue building standing. Now, the Torah scrolls and everything of religious value have been taken out of these buildings.
Scott, we've got a lot of questions for you about security in Gaza, the economic future there. If you'll hold on, I'm going to come back to you after a short break and we'll continue the discussion. Give us a call if you'd like to join the conversation. The number is 800-989-TALK. I'm Lynn Neary. It's Talk of the Nation from NPR News. This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Lynn Neary in Washington, sitting in for Neil Conan. We're talking about the future of Gaza now that Israel has pulled out of that territory. My guest is Scott Wilson, Jerusalem Bureau Chief for The Washington Post. Scott, I wanted to ask you about security in Gaza now. We were talking just before the break about the fact that fires were set in these synagogues. There's also reports I've read about looting in the industrial areas. What does that say about security in Gaza now and the ability of the Palestinians to make that area secure?
Yeah, it's an enormous problem, and it's the most pressing problem facing the Palestinian Authority right now and the Palestinian leader, Mahmoud Abbas. Their strategy was basically to protect anything that Israel left behind that would have value to them, and those were primarily the greenhouses, which employ thousands of Palestinians. They didn't have enough people, essentially, to guard everything. These are settlements that occupied about 20% of Gaza's territory, so they couldn't really guard everything. And so they chose the greenhouses and a few other sites. But there has been widespread looting. I watched Palestinians yesterday just strip from the inside out an enormous factory in the Kfar Darom settlement where they used to make salad and sell all over Israel and employ hundreds of people, and that was just reduced to scrap metal in a very short amount of time. And so it's pretty hard to watch that, and it's really upsetting to Mahmoud Abbas, the leader, who's really hoping that you know, there can be some economic lift and that it will help him govern the place, which is really becoming kind of a proving ground for a future Palestinian state.
Now, just one other question, and that's about the borders. Israel still controls its borders with Gaza, but the border between Gaza and Egypt, it's open at this point, is it not?
It is. I mean, it's largely open. The Egyptians have deployed hundreds of troops there, but they're letting a lot of Palestinians who were basically have been in the Sinai Peninsula for months, not unable to get across. They're letting them come in, So there's a lot of passage back and forth right now, and it's really angering the Israelis, who thought they had a solid deal and that this border was going to be tight. The Egyptians and the Palestinians have said they're going to allow one more day of this sort of free passage that's reuniting a lot of families, and there's a lot of trade going on, not all of it entirely legal, smuggling cigarettes and things like that. But it could become a security issue very quickly, and Israel is not going to let it happen for very long. And so they're going to, essentially they've said that they're going to crack down on that border stuff tomorrow.
All right. Thanks so much for joining us, Scott.
Thank you.
Scott Wilson is the Jerusalem Bureau Chief for The Washington Post. He joined us by phone from his home in Jerusalem. If you'd like to join our discussion, if you have any questions about the Israeli pullout from Gaza, the number is 1-800-989-8255. The pullout from Gaza marks an historic step in the Middle East peace process, but as we've heard, it is riddled with problems and potential pitfalls. There's fear and suspicion on the part of both Palestinians and Israelis. Both Palestinian President Mahmoud Abbas and Israeli Prime Minister Ariel Sharon face criticisms from their parties and their constituencies. To better understand the political fallout from the Gaza pullout, we turn now to Shibli Telhami, the Anwar Sadat Professor for Peace and Development at the University of Maryland, and he joins us from his home in Maryland. Thanks for being with us.
My pleasure.
And also Uri Dromi joins us by phone from his home in Jerusalem. He's the Director of International Outreach for the Israel Democracy Institute. Thanks to you also, and welcome to the program.
Good to be with you.
Let me start with you, Uri. Israel still controls utilities, power, water, also the border between Gaza and Israel. How much does the pullout then really change life within Gaza, would you say?
I think it changed a lot because, first of all, we're not there. Israeli settlers are not there. Israeli army is not there. And I think you could see on television that people can roam around free, and I think it's a good sign for everybody around here. You're right, though, that because of being there for 30 and being in charge there for 38 years, we still provide electricity and water, etc. But this will have to be developed in the future. I mean, there's no way in which we can pull out, and you don't want us to cut the electricity or the water.
Yeah. We spoke earlier with a settler who was had to leave the Gaza, obviously feeling very bitter and angry about it. But what would you say is the general feeling among most Israelis about this development?
Well, it's a mixed feeling. On one hand, people still lick the wounds of this traumatic event, and obviously the sight of Palestinians setting fire to synagogue is not a heartening one. But basically, and it shows also in the public opinion polls, people are supportive of the move. Some kind of sense of relief. You know, we're out. And now it's up to the Palestinians to take on from there.
Professor Telhami, I've read quotes from Palestinian leaders saying the fact that Israel does still control the borders, that Palestinians are still economically dependent on Israel, in essence this means that the occupation continues.
No question that if you read the statements, not only Palestinian leaders, but particularly the militant groups who are claiming victory for this, are arguing that occupation isn't over. But yet, at the same time, there's no question that there is so much celebration, venting, breathing fresh air, and you really have to put it in a bit of historical perspective. I think we're really not getting the full picture of this. We're focused only on the Israeli withdrawal as such. But remember, Gaza has a population with the highest density in the world. The vast majority of people, over 75% of the population, are refugees to begin with. Those are refugees who left their homes in 48 that were mostly around Tel Aviv and Jaffa and other places in the south. And half of those refugees still live in refugee camps today. They've been refugees since 1948. They were controlled by Egypt from 48 to 67. Egypt never annexed it, basically kept it until there was a final settlement to the issue, and then they were under occupation for since 1967. So it's been an extraordinary period for the people of Gaza. It's been a period in which they have witnessed no freedom. The vast majority of people have been born there and in refugee camps. And so I think when you look at that and you look at this moment where there's far less control in this densely populated area, you have evacuation of 25% of Gaza that was occupied by, you know, less than 10,000 people, including some prime land by the beaches and so forth. You can understand the sense that, of some relief and celebration, even as there was so much worry and concern about what might come next.
That's two big worries, security and the economy. Let's start with the economy, because, of course, the pictures we're seeing show a place which is really in rubbles, in rubble. I mean, the buildings have all been torn down. We've just been hearing that there's been some looting, particularly in some of the assets that have been left behind by the Israelis. How do you begin to rebuild this economy, Professor?
It's very difficult. I mean, let's look at it. We are the most important power in the world. We have so many resources. Look at the challenge we faced in New Orleans and what happened to the population and our inability to deal with it. You can imagine when you have one of the poorest places in the world with very few resources, no national government, per capita income of less than 1,000, how difficult and challenging it is to deal with that. I mean, we can't always put it in perspective, and I think, sure, the Palestinians have to do their own. They need to get their house in order. They've got a lot of sorting out to do politically. But in the end, they're almost entirely dependent on the outside world in the short term for economic aid. And that economic aid is not only for building projects, but it has to also do with politics. People are talking about strengthening an authority of Mahmoud Abbas, who in essence put most of his eggs in the American basket. And to some extent, the Israeli basket. He's dependent on both. And for him to win politically in an environment where he had nothing to do with the Israeli withdrawal, this is a decision that happened before he came to power. Palestinians don't give him credit for it. Hamas is claiming their credit for it. And for him to show anything to strengthen himself against the rising power of Hamas politically, he's going to have to show something, at least on the economy, on corruption, on a peace process, and on all of these things, he's dependent on the outside world.
All right, we are discussing the Gaza after the Israeli pullout. The number is 1-800-989-8255 if you'd like to join the discussion. We're going to take a call now from Peter, and he's calling from Columbus, Ohio. Go ahead, Peter.
Thank you for taking my call. I was wondering, it seems like I read last week that Hamas revealed the identities of its leaders in the Gaza Strip, and it seems like they're flexing their muscle a bit. Who do you think comes out on top, the Palestinian Authority or the Hamas, when it comes to the Gaza Strip?
All right, thanks so much for that question. I'd like both our guests perhaps to respond to that. Mr. Dromi?
Well, first of all, apart from the Hamas, there's the Islamic Jihad, which blatantly says it's going to continue the armed struggle and the terrorist attack. But the Hamas is playing a double game here. On one hand, they're participating in the political arena, and they're going to take part in the elections, coming elections in January. But at the same time, they keep the military and terroristic apparatus, and they say openly that when the time arises, the opportunity arises, they're going to use it. And I think I understand what Professor Tarami said about the need for Mahmoud Abbas to show if he takes on the Hamas, he needs to at least show some kind of a reward, economic reward or incentive. But there is, a basic principle here that you can't play it both ways. You can't, I'm talking about the Hamas, you can't on one hand pretend you're a political or civic organization and on the other hand keep a terrorist and and still be a armed militia. At one point, there should be one authority and one armed forces, and therefore, there's no point in prolonging it forever.
Professor Tilhami, why is Hamas gaining support among Palestinians?
Well, there are a couple of things. First of all, if you look at the ineffectiveness of the Palestinian Authority in delivering after Oslo. I mean, first, there was the economic promise, and second, there was the promise of independence. When the Oslo agreement collapsed in 2000, there was no alternative for the Palestinian Authority to deliver, and people had paid a price. And so Hamas picked up the slack, at least on that, and certainly it had claimed that its militancy is what drove the Israelis out. And in some ways, the Israeli internal discourse reflected the realization that it was a heavy cost they were paying that is, in essence, pushing them out, although obviously there was very little incentive to stay, unlike in some places in the West Bank where many Israelis really want to lay claim to those territories. So it's both of these things. But for that reason, Hamas is strong. But the second reason is corruption, no question. I think the Palestinian Authority, and prior to Mahmoud Abbas and since Mahmoud Abbas had taken over, has been plagued with accusations of corruption, particularly in Gaza. And Hamas has portrayed itself as being cleaner. And frankly, when you look at the local elections, you find that Hamas candidates win by virtue of portraying themselves as being outside of this power circle. And part of the problem for Mahmoud Abbas now is that in order for him to gain the broadest support among the Palestinian public, he really has three areas: economics, peace process, and the corruption issue.
All right, let me just remind our listeners for a moment that you are listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. Go ahead, Professor Tilhami.
Yeah, and on the corruption issue, I think here's the dilemma. I think he obviously, if you look at what has transpired over the past few weeks, when a very important figure in the PLO, the former intelligence chief Musa Arafat, the cousin of former Palestinian President Yasser Arafat, was assassinated. Clearly, the authority had no answer to it, couldn't control it, couldn't stop it, and that was almost entirely over accusation of corruption, not dealing with corruption. But for Mahmoud Abbas, who wants to deal with this issue, his dilemma is at the same time that he needs to confront the militants, and as Mr. Dromi was saying, to show that there's only one Palestinian authority and therefore at some point be able to disarm Hamas. He needs allies, and those allies who are around him who could in the short term stand with him if he wants to take some action are many of the same people who are being accused of corruption. So it's a dilemma. It's a very difficult one. It's one he cannot on his own pull himself out of. I mean, there's got to be a lot of international cooperation on this issue.
Mr. Dromi,
may I add something, Lynn?
Yes.
There's a chicken and egg here. I agree 100% with the Professor Tilhami, that Mahmoud Abbas, in order to have some kind of leverage, he needs immediately support. But support will not come because of the corruption. So it's a vicious cycle, and at one point you have to stop it. Accountability and transparency, I think that the Palestinians themselves call. Whenever I talk with a Palestinian, they urge their leaders to go for it. So I don't know where to start, but I just want to make one comment that up till now there was the Israeli occupation to blame, and now we're out of Gaza, so it's up for them. But we shouldn't look at it as if from now on the Palestinians are left alone. I think it's in the best interest of Israel to help if the Palestinians want. And we should start thinking about the situation as a win-win situation rather than a zero-sum game.
Yeah. Professor Tilhami, with just a short time left in this segment, what are the next steps for the Palestinians?
Well,
briefly.
I mean, now it's all about domestic politics in the short term, and clearly Mahmoud Abbas needs to revive the support within Fatah first and foremost, and then get the public on his side. It's a tall order, but in the short term, he needs an infusion of funds that will go directly into economic projects. certainly he needs transparency. I think the Palestinian Authority has come a long way with Mr. Fayyad, who has credibility internationally. They need the help. I think realistically in the next 6 months, both Israel and the Palestinian areas will be highly focused on domestic politics before they engage in real negotiations.
All right. Thanks to both of you for joining us today.
Thank you.
Uri Dromi is the Director of International Outreach for the Israel Democracy Institute. He joined us by phone from his home in Jerusalem. Shelby Telhami is a Senior Fellow at the Sabon Center at the Brookings Institute, and he joined us from his home in Maryland. When we come back from a short break, we turn to other news of the day, the John Roberts confirmation hearings. I'm Lynn Neary. It's Talk of the Nation from NPR News.